We were discussing on Monday the contribution that Socrates made to a theory of concepts, his discovery of inductive reasoning, and the theory of general definitions. May I please have your attention? The method developed by Socrates has had a tremendous importance on the development of the abstracting quality of the human mind. The process of conceptualization, the formation of concepts, the capacity to think about ideas instead of thinking only about sticks and stones, individual things, but the capacity of the human mind to remove itself from individual objects and to think of what in philosophy is sometimes called essences, the definition of things. And pure abstractions, which exist only in the mind, like the concept of truth, the concept of beauty, the concept of goodness, even a simple concept like the concept of a table, it took the human mind untold centuries to develop the capacity to rise above the experience of just the individual table, the individual tree, and to arrive at the general conception of what is a tree, what is a table, what is a bush as distinguished from a tree. The whole concept of a genus and a species, the difference between one and the other, and the numerous species that you could have in a genus. I've forgotten the figure. I once saw how many thousands of species of bees that there are. The idea of being able to classify, to make distinctions, to organize human knowledge, which would have been impossible without this method. And of course, as I explained to you, it's a key to the scientific method, because as Socrates used his method, it's very easy to see how he was constantly testing answers to questions. The answer became a hypothesis. You say, this is piety, or this is what I mean by beauty or by justice. And then you begin to test it out, and you find that it's inadequate for certain reasons. But it's exactly, of course, what happens in a laboratory. And the basis for the scientific method is to be found in what Aristotle called induction, inductive reasoning, and the theory of general definitions, for which he gave credit to Socrates. The influence of this theory, too, can be felt on educational process, on our educational theories and educational methods. The strong American preference for discussion groups, for the seminar, for the small class, for the tutorial system. You have it in England and to some degree here. These can be traced back to the Socratic method. That is, the face-to-face meeting between the teacher and the pupil, both engaged in a common undertaking, both searching, and the teacher willing to learn in the process, not that he comes with a ready answer. In the Euthyphro, for example, it's very easy to see how, at some point or other, Socrates could have answered the question, could have given Euthyphro the answer. Euthyphro came close to it, but didn't quite make it. Socrates could have given him the answer, but he never did. And this was typical, because it would have meant a frustration of the whole effort if Socrates supplied the answer. The answer has to come from the person himself. He discovers it. He'll never forget it if he discovers it. He'll probably forget it 10 minutes later if Socrates told him the answer. So the difference in the makes a difference in every respect. The word education that we have comes from the Latin educo, E-D-U-C-O, which means drawing out, which is exactly, of course, the Socratic idea, which comes from Socrates. This was supposed to be education for us. And we try time and again to rediscover it and to use it as much as circumstances will permit. The drawing out from the pupil himself what is in him, or with some help, can be found to be in him. Socrates thought of himself and said so, that he was only a midwife. He was not a teacher in our sense of the term, but only a midwife. As he helped Euthyphro, as Euthyphro gave birth to the ideas which were in Euthyphro and not in Socrates. Euthyphro was helpful to Socrates in the same way. He wasn't as expert as Socrates was. But Socrates didn't come with the answers. He didn't know what piety was. There's no indication that he had the answer. He probably had better answers than Euthyphro did. But that still wasn't sufficient. So it's an endless inquiry that he was engaged upon. One other aspect of this particular point is that Socrates, through his method and through his beliefs, eventually, when the influence was felt, revolutionized from a class standpoint some fundamental preconceptions of society, in that Socrates believed that the effort of knowledge cannot be the monopoly of any one class. He didn't talk, unlike others in Athens, of his character, the type of person that he was. Unlike them, he didn't limit himself to just the upper classes, that just the sons of the upper classes are worthy of cultivation, that they have refined minds, they have better minds, they have minds, while the other people are mindless. They're only creatures to be used. But Socrates talked, as an example I gave you some weeks ago in another context altogether, in the Meno, he talked to a slave, and he showed that the slave knew just as much after the inquiry was pushed sufficiently, just as much about Euclidean theorems, the relationships between one side of a triangle to another side of a triangle, as anybody could know. Well, this was revolutionary for the Athenian people. He talked to manual workers, people who made a living by the use of their hands, who were held in contempt by the upper class Athenians. But to Socrates, this was a man, he had a mind, he had a soul. It was important for him to take care of his soul, just as it was for anybody else. Well, who can measure the influence of this kind of teaching? It wasn't a teaching in that he formulated a principle, but that he lived out his principle, as he lived out his principles in all other relationships. Well, we could spend more time on this, but I'm trying to give you the sufficient insight into what the Socratic method meant in terms of the development of our civilization and what it means to us in our recognition of what we have, that it has a long and difficult history. Now let me go to one other aspect of the Socratic inheritance, if you want to call it that. And this is the belief in a higher law that Socrates had, a law that was higher than the law of the state. And what came from that, his theory of civil disobedience. Again, a topic of immeasurable influence, and particularly in our own day, we have seen how profound that influence has been and can be. Let me explain what Socrates did here. It's one of the most interesting aspects of the life and thought of Socrates. In the Crito and in the Apology, Socrates is concerned, as you know, with the question of obedience to law and what happens when there is, as in his case, a willful violation, a knowing violation of the law. What's the philosophy that is involved in this? What are the philosophical problems involved in that kind of a situation? In the Crito, he argues that no state can survive if its laws and if the judgments of its courts are not obeyed. That would mean if there were widespread disobedience, the dissipation of the state, the breaking up of the state, the breaking up of the society. Even if, he argued, as in his own case, the court judgment may be unjust, as he certainly believed the judgment against him was unjust, the judgment must still be obeyed. So, to begin with, Socrates was no anarchist. He believed, shall we say, in law and order. A man, he argued, to justify this position, ought to obey the laws of his country for several reasons. First, because he owes to the laws of his country the same kind of regard that a person has or should have or should owe to his parents. In the Crito, he argued, for example, if it weren't for the laws, he would not even be the child of his parents. By law, he is the child of his parents. By law, his parents were compelled to send him to school, to educate him, to feed him, to clothe him, so that his very birth and upbringing depended upon the laws. So he owes the laws the same kind of respect and regard that he owes, without question, he didn't question this at all, to his parents. Secondly, he ought to obey the laws because of a kind of a social contract, because he had agreed to do so. He had undertaken to do so. An implied contract, this is one of the earliest expressions here of the social contract theory, with which we'll deal more elaborately when we come to John Locke. But here you have certainly an expression of a social contract theory, an implied contract that a citizen would obey the laws of his country. If he were to violate, therefore, the judgment that was handed down against him, he would be breaking the laws in at least these two respects. Now, Socrates went on to argue, and particularly in the Apology, the two have to be read together, the Crito and the Apology. Oh, there may be some discrepancies between the two if you read them separately, but if you read them together, I think they are consistent one with the other. In the Apology, he argues that he would not obey a law or an order of a court in two types of situations. He owes general obedience to the laws, but there are exceptions. The exceptions fall into two categories, and they're very interesting. They are still of very lively importance to us. The first is, if the law or the court order what purports to be the law by a lawful agency of the state seeks to compel him to do what he would consider a most grave injustice to another person. And he gives two instances from his own experience, his own life, of this type of a situation. The first was when there was a democracy in Athens. Socrates lived through some revolutionary changes in his own city-state. During the democracy, when after a war, the generals were going to be tried for having neglected to bury the dead soldiers. This was a grave charge. Burial, as you'll see in the Antigone when we come to that, played a very important role in the mores of the people, as it does in our society too. Problem of a decent burial. We don't talk about it, we don't discuss it, we don't think about it, because very seldom do you have the problem. But the problem does come up. It came up in the Antigone, and it came up with the Athenians when there was the charge that the Athenian generals had neglected to bury the slain soldiers. And it was proposed to try them en masse. It was to be a kind of a show trial, the kind of a trial that we've become accustomed to more. It happened more often under Stalin in Russia. It was a mass trial. A show trial, this is what it's often called. It becomes a kind of a lynching operation, but in the guise of the law. Socrates said that this was contrary to the law, and he, being one of the 50 officials who was supposed to carry this out, refused. He was the only one who refused. The men were entitled to individual trials and not to a show trial. So for this insistence on his part, he said that he faced imprisonment and possibly even death, but nothing would move him from becoming a party to what would have been a grave injustice against the individuals on trial. It would have been a lynching, according to Socrates. That's one instance. The second instance came up during the reign of the so-called 30 tyrants, the oligarchy, when the oligarchy, the government of the day, ordered Socrates and four other officials, he was then an official, to go to Salamis and to bring back Leon of Salamis, who was to be put to death in Athens. Socrates took the position that this was an unlawful, unjust order. Again, it was a lynching. And he, the only one of the five officials, refused to carry out the order, even if it should have meant his imprisonment or his death. My great and only care, he said, was, in relation to these instances, my great and only care was lest I should do an unrighteous or an unholy thing. These were unrighteous acts, and he wouldn't have done them. So these are two instances of one kind of a case where civil disobedience, according to the terminology we would use today, would have been justified according to Socrates. The second is one that involved himself. The second type is one that involved himself. At his own trial, he had an opportunity at various junctures in the proceedings to suggest to the jury of 500 a way that would have saved him from the judgment of death. It's like our bargain pleas that we have in our system. You make some kind of an arrangement with the prosecutor, the district attorney. He's charging you with murder in the first degree. He would have to put you on trial, and he might lose. So you and he come to an agreement on some lesser charge, manslaughter, second degree, third degree, whatever it may be, and you plead guilty. But we have, these things happen every day. The whole problem of bargaining over a plea. Now, this happened also in the Athenian system. Well, one could have suggested to the jury, as Socrates knew, and he mentions this, some lighter penalty. And what was suggested to him that he might ask for was that he would tell the jury that whatever he may have done in the past was done, but whatever sentence they want to impose on him, they can impose, but suspend it pending his good behavior, subject to his good behavior. In the future, he will behave differently. This was what he had a chance to do. This was his reaction to that. I read this to you from the apology in another situation, but because it can be used for different purposes, and I have used it for another purpose, but let me use it now for this supremely important purpose. If you say to me, he says to the jury, if you say to me, Socrates, this time we will not listen to Onitis, the prosecutor, and you shall be let off, but on one condition, that you are not to inquire and speculate in this way anymore, and that if you are caught doing so again, you will die. Kind of a probation. If this was the condition on which you let me go, I should reply, men of Athens, I have the warmest affection for you, but I shall obey God rather than you. And while I have life and strength, I shall never cease from the practice and teaching of philosophy. For know that this is the command of God. And I believe that no greater good has ever happened in the state than my service to God. For I do nothing but go about persuading you all, old and young alike, not to take thought for your persons or your properties, but first and chiefly to care about the greatest improvement of the soul. This could have been said by any religious martyr who was charged with teaching heretic thoughts, heretical ideas. And his defense could have been, no, the ideas I have are of the utmost importance to the salvation of you people, your souls. For an eternity of time depend upon what I consider to be these fundamental truths. You want to shut me up? Well, you can shut me up. But as long as I have breath, I must teach these fundamental truths. And if you're going to hang me, if you're going to kill me, well, that's your business. But I know my business. It's God's command to me. St. Paul had to do this. St. Peter had to do this. They were both crucified in Rome. And there were, of course, countless other Christian and Jewish martyrs over the centuries. People who took this kind of a position that Socrates took. Because they believed that it's not merely their own individual soul's salvation that was at stake, but that God, in his grace, gave them an insight into certain truths which they had to share with mankind. And for that, they were willing to risk their lives, which they did. I tell you that virtue is not given by money, but that from virtue comes money and every other good of a man, public as well as private. This is my teaching. By that, of course, he means that he didn't care about money and every other good. He meant all good things, whatever you put a price on, whatever you put a value on, all those things come from this kind of virtue, the virtue of the soul. This is my teaching. And if this is the doctrine which corrupts the youth, then I am a mischievous person. But if anyone says that this is not my teaching, he is speaking an untruth. And so, men of Athens, I say to you, do as Anytus bids, or do not as Anytus bids. Acquit me or not acquit me. But whichever you do, understand that I shall never alter my ways, not even if I have to die many times. That is, he will disobey that law, a law which goes to the very soul of the man. It's, of course, this is a religious position. And essentially, Socrates could be said to have been a religious martyr, just as he was a martyr to civil liberties, just as the religious martyrs were also martyrs to civil liberty. Because religious liberty is dependent upon freedom of speech, the freedom to do missionary work for a religious person. This is the way he speaks. This is the way he uses freedom of speech and freedom of the press. Socrates believed that to commit a crime against his own soul was to commit a crime against God, because he had this mission, as he felt, from God. To search for the truth was his only reason for living, because that meant living for a soul. That meant caring for a soul. If he can't care for a soul, life is of utter uselessness to him. He might just as well be dead, because life is identified with the life of the soul for him. Animals also eat. Animals propagate. Animals have their sleep, their rest, and their movements. But he's a man. And what makes him a man, according to Socrates, was a soul. And the way to live as a man was to care for a soul, in his sense of the term, as I have tried to explain to you. Socrates was given the opportunity to escape, as you know, from the Crito, but he refused. He knew that the judgment against him was unjust, and yet he refused to escape. Why? Because it was no injury to his soul to die, that is, for his body to die. To suffer a wrong is not a moral outrage. It may be a moral outrage for the offender, but it's not a moral outrage for the victim. If he were asked to do something which would be a moral outrage, he would refuse. But if he has to die, the offense is committed by the man who kills him. If the state, if the jury wants to kill him, they kill his body, It's wrong that they should do that, but it would be wrong for him to run away, because it is not a hurt to his soul. If they ask him to do something which is an offense to his soul, he won't do it. In the two other instances, to have done what he was asked to do would have been a violence to his soul. A violence to his soul to do violence to another person unjustly. A just man doesn't do that. A man who knows, who understands what it means to be a man, wouldn't do that. So he wouldn't allow himself to be used as an instrument of injustice to another person. And then when the shoe is on his own foot, he took a similar position. He will not allow him. His innermost self must be allowed to live. And if it can't live, then his body might just as well die. In the Crito, he said, the laws say to him, the laws of Athens, after he has refused to escape, now you depart in innocence, that is when you take the cup of hemlock, a sufferer and not a doer of evil. That's the important distinction. A victim, not of the laws, but of men, as men who made a misjudgment. There was no quarrel about the laws, but the way the laws were used by the jury. So he was a victim. But if you go forth, that is, if you escape, returning evil for evil and injury for injury, breaking the covenants and agreements which you have made with us, wronging those whom you ought least of all to wrong, that is to say, to yourself, your friends, your country, and us, the laws, we shall be angry with you while you live. And our brethren, the laws in the world below, will receive you as an enemy, for they will know that you have done your best to destroy us. Well, now, taking the Crito and the Apology together, Socrates formulated what has become the classical rationale of civil disobedience, as it was interpreted, and correctly so, by Gandhi, and in our own time by Dr. Martin Luther King. They formulated these principles more expressly using the conceptualization method which Socrates taught them, as he had taught us. So the principles are these. First, a person who takes a position of civil disobedience acts openly, just as Socrates did. I will always do such and such. I make no secret of it. If you let me go, I will do this and that. He acts openly. Secondly, he states his reasons for his actions. He's a teacher, a moral teacher in the process. He's not a criminal who operates at night in the darkness and doesn't want anybody to know what he's doing. He doesn't violate the laws that way. He violates them openly. He wants the whole world to know, and he wants the world to know why he is doing it, as Gandhi did, as Dr. Martin Luther King did. They call the press, as it were, to watch and see what they're going to do. Thirdly, they appeal for change, as they first of all ask the government time and again to prevent this predicament, to keep them from doing what they were planning to do, by changing the laws, by substituting justice for injustice, equality for inequality, whatever the wrong may be, to put a right in the place of wrong. But if the government, the people don't listen, then they resort to civil disobedience. Fourth, they submit to the penalty. Gandhi went to prison time and again. Dr. Martin Luther King was in jail several times. Socrates drank the cup of hemlock when he had an opportunity to run away. They refuse to become fugitives. This is their society. This is where they want to see the wrong righted, the injustice made into justice. Otherwise, there's no point to the whole operation. If they want to run away, why don't they run away before they do what they do? If they want to disconnect themselves from the society. But the whole point is that they are in the society, inseparable from it. They won't run away. And they'll do what they have to do by reason of what they consider to be the command of God to them. And finally, they will do no violence. They will not commit an injustice. They will suffer an injustice. But they themselves will not commit an injustice, either to another person or to themselves, as in the case of Socrates. The Socratic dialogues that we've been reading have become a kind of a textbook for countless people who have been concerned with the whole process of philosophy and justification of civil disobedience. Are there any questions? Yes, sir. I'm sorry, but... Oh, no, I don't equate it with violence. No. I put them together, but not that they're necessarily the same thing. By violence, in the case of Socrates, he meant violence to the laws. It's violating. We get the same word, violate, violence, the same root idea. However, of course, it is true of Gandhi and of Dr. Martin Luther King and of Socrates and of many others who've practiced civil disobedience that they will not use violence in the sense of physical violence. But their whole appeal is a moral appeal. They want society to mend its ways, and the appeal has to be a moral and a rational appeal through civil disobedience. Yes.
Yesterday you said that one of the dangers of the Socratic thought would be that a person might begin to separate themselves from their fellow members, and in that way the others become just. And then today, talking about the conditions under which, people should commit themselves to the being, they feel they have to. What are the things that
Well, there are all kinds of dilemmas that human beings get into. There are no easy answers to complicated problems that human beings are compelled to face from time to time. The danger that I spoke of on Monday was in a totally different context. That is the separation of the individual who concentrates on his own soul and the salvation of the soul could lead to, as it did, for example, in medieval Christianity, to monasticism. The separation of the individual from society, there were monastic orders that did that. Oh, the person gets into a cell, he's thinking only of his soul. He spends his days only to keep his soul clean and pure for what he hopes will be an eternity of time. He withdraws essentially from society. In the Essenes, for example, the Dead Sea Scrolls were probably scrolls which were written and kept by the Essenes, who lived on the shores of the Dead Sea in caves. As much as we know about them, they They probably tried to separate themselves from the rest of society. They thought society was impure, it was unjust, so they withdrew, even from their families. No wives, no children. They were concerned only with certain purification rites and rituals. There is that danger if you concentrate on your soul and nothing else. Socrates was not that kind of a man. You could avoid the danger. I'm not saying that everybody falls into that trap. There is the danger. And the danger represents an important, very important strand in the development of civilization. Well, we face it constantly in our own society. There are people who would like to do that. Some people who do that. Some people who go into communes for that purpose. They don't like the system, the whole order. Well, they can't go to a desert island. There aren't any such. So they form a commune in which they think that they will be as clean and as untouched by the injustices of the society as possible. The Socrates was not that kind. Socrates was very much the Athenian. He was thoroughly the Athenian. He believed in the importance of a soul, but nonetheless an Athenian. And he wouldn't leave Athens. Life without Athens was unbearable, was unthinkable for him. So you don't have to move in the direction of the danger. You can try to compensate for that tendency by bringing in other considerations, which is what he did. Well, a man has to make a decision as to what he wants more. The Berrigan brothers at one point made a decision to be fugitives from justice. It was a decision that they had to make. Nobody could make it for them. Whether they were right or wrong, I think, is a matter of grave debate. They were not acting consistently with these principles that we were discussing. Well, that's a decision they have to make. Okay, so they had to make it, and they made it. And eventually they had to pay a price for being fugitives, because that in itself is a crime. So that it could be a kind of an endless chain of crimes that one is committing. They committed a crime, they were fugitives from justice, which in itself is a crime, so that when they were caught, they had to face a number of criminal prosecutions. Oh, you have to argue this out. This is not the occasion when I would be prepared to argue it, and I don't want to do that. All I'm trying to do here is to show you the importance of the Socratic contribution, which is much, much larger than what is implied in the action of the Berrigans when they were fugitives. They were practicing civil disobedience up to that point. But whether or not after that point, when they became fugitives, they could still claim to be within the context of civil disobedience would be a very important and difficult question. You see that? Right. Yes? Well, I don't know, of course. It's an implied. When do you agree to the social contract? It's implied. When do you agree to the social contract that operates between you and me? There is such a contract. I have a contract with you to come in prepared, to treat you respectfully as a gentleman would, and in talking to others who are ladies and gentlemen. You owe me obligations. Well, I never sat down and spelled out a contract with you. You and I never sat down and formalized the terms and conditions. There are other terms and conditions. I laid down a condition that I don't want to see a newspaper in front of a student. I wouldn't want to see any impolite action on the part of a student. You wouldn't want to see it from me. There is no contract that's written out. But Of course, there are implied contracts all of the time. My relations with my wife, that I sit down and that we sit down and make a contract as to how we would treat one another, that I make a contract with my son. And yet there are implied contracts, and God forbid if I should violate a condition of that contract, there'd be hell to pay, and rightly so. So life is full of these implied contracts. I walk out into the hall and I have implied contracts to avoid bumping into people, pushing them, yelling at them. They have all kinds of obligations to me. Every time you walk into a restaurant, there's an implied contract about the food you will be served, how you will be served. You don't make a contract at the door. Life would be intolerable if we didn't have this idea of the implied contract. Now, we'll have more of an opportunity to discuss this social contract idea when we come to John Locke. Let me say something to you what I want to do on Friday. I think there's one other aspect of Socrates that I want to talk about, but I think I probably will skip it. I don't know, because I'm anxious to get to Sophocles, and I'll think it over. If I do discuss another aspect of Socrates, it will be only briefly, and in any case, we will start a discussion of the plays of Sophocles that you have.